This interview is being conducted on Wednesday, November 5th, 2014, with Mr. Frank Trout at the Indian Prairie Library in Darien, Illinois. My name is Deb Barrett. Mr. Trout was born on December 9th, 1944, in Chicago, Illinois. He is a retired police sergeant and fire chief for the village of Westmont, and learned of the Veterans History Project through his brother-in-law. Mr. Trout has kindly consented to be interviewed for this project. Here is his story. So, Frank, where were you living when you entered the service? What was your life like at that time, just before you went in?
At the time, I was working construction. I was living in the village of Westmont. And a friend of mine and I had been considering going into the military. And Vietnam was starting to cook up.
What year was this?
This was 1965.
And how old were you at the time? 20?
At that time, I was 20 years old.
Okay.
And my friend and I, we said, you know, Vietnam is starting to cook. And I told my friend, hey, I'm going to join the Army. And I said, do you want to come along? And he said, yeah, let's go.
So what prompted you to want to join the Army?
Another friend of mine,
okay,
was a paratrooper, and you know, we talked about it, and I really respected the man. He was about 10 years older than me.
Okay.
And I thought, you know, that is pretty cool, and if you're going to be in something, you know, try and be the best.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, Special Forces was starting to become known, the Green Berets.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, hey, that'd be cool too. And so I joined the Army to get into the paratroopers and then go into Special Forces.
Was there a military history in your family?
My uncles served in World War II. My father was a railroad engineer during World War II. And had already had a family, and so he was bypassed for the military.
Okay.
And so I was nothing other than my uncles for World War II.
How did your family react to your decision?
My father was concerned because of Vietnam, as was my mother.
Uh-huh.
But they also knew that When I set my mind to do something, I'm going to do it.
Okay. So you were 20 years old. You enlisted in the Army. Where were you inducted?
I was inducted in Chicago. And I can remember my friends and I leaving Chicago for Fort Knox, Kentucky, for basic training. We left on a train at night.
Well, let me go back. When you got your induction was in, where in Chicago was it? Do you remember?
I can't remember Dearborn Street wanted to jump in my mind, but I don't know why. But anyway, there was an induction center downtown Chicago.
Okay. And what happened when you got to your induction? What was it like?
Well, I remember just a bunch of guys standing around, and most of them were draftees.
Okay.
And I was regular, they call it RA, Regular Army.
Okay.
Because we joined for 3 years. And
draftees got 2 years?
And draftees got two.
Right.
And I heard a lot of moaning and groaning. And to me, this was the great adventure.
Okay.
And I was all hopped up about it. Mm-hmm. And along with serving our country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was, I looked at it as like another Korea. Vietnam would be over in about 2.5-3 years, just like Korea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were stopping the communists from taking over another country.
Okay.
And so it was my turn to step up and do my duty.
Okay.
And so that's why we, you know, besides being the great adventure, that's what we decided to do, my buddy and I.
So how adventurous was the induction itself?
I had men putting their hands where they'd never put them before. The doctors and whatnot. And you're standing around naked with a bunch of other people other than your BVDs.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this is the Army now. And
so they went through a bunch of
tests.
Medical tests.
Bunch of medical tests and everything.
Shots and stuff.
And they said that I was, you know, okay to go. And I think that took like 1 or 2 days to do this. And then we...
So did you get your supplies then, or did you just get a basic uniform, or what?
We got nothing other than we got the physical, and then after we were approved for service,
mm-hmm.
We were hustled into a room. We raised our right hand. It was... Now it was a great thing to be able to serve.
Okay.
I get emotional over it.
Right.
But a lot of people have lost the honor of serving your country.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, and even draftees that I talked to later said that was probably one of the best things they've ever done in their life, even though they went kicking and screaming. And now they could stand proud. They weren't a chicken shit that ran off to Kalamazoo or to Canada or wherever they're going to hide out at. They were man enough to man up and to do their duty.
Okay.
And as for the ones that didn't, I have mixed feelings because I have a lot of friends of mine that evaded the draft either through military or they got married and cranked mm-hmm. out a kid or whatever it was. Because to this day, you can see that they lost honor. They lost their honor
mm-hmm.
by doing that. Some of them will cover up by saying, well, you know, it was a stupid war and whatnot. Well, it didn't really matter whether it was smart or stupid. It's you're standing up doing the right thing at the right time. You believed.
Okay.
And if you weren't willing to do that, well, then you should have enough honor and integrity to say, okay, I don't believe in this, I'm not going to do it, I'm going to burn my draft card or whatever, and refuse to go, but then go to jail for it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't run off like a punk and hide out.
Mm-hmm.
If you truly believe something's wrong, well, then be honorable enough then to pay the consequences, which most people aren't.
Okay.
All right, so that's what I believe.
Okay. Right? So you were at the induction center, you swore the oath, and then?
And then swore the oath, and later that evening, we were herded on the buses, and we were told just to bring a set of underwear with and something else, and don't worry about anything, that the Army was going to take care of you from that point on.
Did they give you a list of things you were not supposed to bring with you to induction, or...?
If they did, I can't remember.
Okay. Okay. So what happened to the things you had when you got there?
I believe the sergeant did tell us, you know, no alcohol, no drugs, no guns, nothing to get you in trouble with.
Okay.
If you need something, the Army would give it to you.
Okay.
All right?
So when you got on these buses, you were in a uniform?
No.
You were still in your street clothes?
Civilian clothes.
Okay.
They told us just to wear something casual.
Mm-hmm.
That we weren't going to be going anywhere, and if we were going to be going somewhere, the Army would supply it.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I even think the little kit that we took with a toothbrush and everything was issued by the government, so we didn't really bring anything from home.
Okay.
All right. So the little kit I think was from the government or Red Cross somebody, and then.
So you got on the buses.
Got on the buses. Went to the railroad depot.
Was it Union Station?
Union Station.
Okay.
And there we boarded a train for, we're going to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, so we're going to Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay.
So onto the train we go.
And this was a civilian train?
This is a civilian train.
So you were just mixed with everyone or separate cars?
No, we had a car loaded full of Army guys.
Okay.
Now, if there were civilians on board, that's possible. I can't remember. I just remember a bunch of our guys.
Okay.
All right. Remember pulling out of the station. I was so excited. All right. And yes, we're really going. And I remember pulling out of Chicago, I remember looking into the car and seeing all these grown men crying. And even my buddy who I was with was crying because he was leaving home.
Uh-huh. You know?
And for a lot of people, other maybe Boy Scout camp, this was the first time they'd be separated from their parents, I guess.
Right.
You know? But for me, it was, woohoo, great adventure.
And how much had people heard about what was going on in Vietnam at this point?
It was on TV every night.
So you knew
what was
waiting for you.
Right, right.
Okay.
Well, I thought that we would go out, fight a battle all day, and then go back to Saigon and party all night. I don't know why I was thinking that, but
because
I was 20
years old.
Yeah, I thought you went out and kicked ass all day, mm-hmm. and then you got cleaned up at night and went and partied in Saigon. Right?
Okay.
Because I kind of like saw both of that on TV.
Right.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Reality, huh?
Yeah, reality.
Okay, so you got to Fort Campbell. That was probably about 6 hours.
Yeah, something like that. We got there, and it was dark out. We got into the train station in Louisville, got off the train, and then I remember this is my first time I got involved with segregation. I saw the white washrooms and the mm-hmm. black washrooms, the white water fountains and the black water mm-hmm. fountains. Okay, and I'm going like, what's that all about?
Yeah.
Okay, and
were all the guys on your who had come down with you, were they all white? Were
no,
they
no,
mixed?
They were mixed. And there was more white than black.
Right. Right.
And Hispanic, you know, and everything
yeah.
else. And so we're down on it like, well, what's this all about, you know? And even though there was all the racial stuff was going on in the 60s.
Right.
You know, you're watching on TV, but until you actually see it mm-hmm. in real life, now you see it, okay? So anyway, I always remember that in the railroad depot in Louisville. Then they herded us onto Greyhound buses, and then from Louisville we went off to Fort Knox.
Okay.
And
were you going to Fort Knox or Fort Campbell?
No, Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Okay. Okay.
Did I say Fort Campbell?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Anyway, so off to Fort Knox, Kentucky, for our basic training.
Okay.
Got off the buses. We're greeted by our friendly sergeant.
And how did he greet you?
He greeted us, told us that he would be our mother, our father, our he was God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And if we needed to talk to God, that he'd be available. All right? And so, and just, this is what we did, and this is how you're going to change from being a civilian to being a military man. And this is, and everybody was treated the same. I remember being, you know, you got clothing, you got where you're going to sleep. They took you to the barracks. Everywhere we went, we either marched or we ran, right? And so everything was at a double time. And they double timed us to chow. They gave us something to eat. They double timed us over to get all of our clothes. They double timed us to, everybody went in and got a haircut. Everybody got the same haircut. And everybody was made the same. So if you were a college, we had college kids,
mm-hmm.
we had high school dropouts, we had lowlifes, we had everything. And we were all together, and the Army didn't care, because we were all going to become soldiers.
Right.
All right?
So what did you...
Important thing.
Yeah.
That's important.
So you got your supplies when you got down to Fort Knox.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff, what was in your...
We had everything from shaving devices, soap, you know, everything you need. We had underwear, socks, shoes, and they tried to fit you. They tried.
<Yeah. laughs>
They threw you clothing, and then, you know, you put it on, and that was it, you know. But they did try to, you know, small, medium, large, and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it, you know, and then you were... Everybody got dressed. We had a standard, which you had to meet.
A standard what?
A standard, you know, like your dress code. You got dressed in your
okay.
basically fatigues.
Mm-hmm.
Your belt buckle is on. You have your dig line, which
okay.
is your button line. Goes down, meets your belt button. And you can see Everything is still that way today.
That's right. It still lines up.
Right. Everything had to line up. Everything had to be precise. And even in your fatigues, right?
And where did you store your stuff? Did you have a foot locker?
We had a foot locker and we had a wall locker, but most of the stuff was in the foot locker.
Did it have to be in a certain order?
Everything had to be in a certain order. They showed us how to make a bed. Now, I was ahead of the game there because my mother showed me, since I was a kid, how to make a bed with the military corners and everything like that. And that's how I made my bed as a kid.
Okay.
So, which had to be pulled tight and everything. And so I did that with no problem, all right? And I remember the sergeant would come through every day. He would look at everything. And if he saw something out of line, and he always found something wrong, whether it was wrong or not, he found something wrong. I remember he'd reach up, he'd pull the whole mattress and everything off the bed and throw it on the floor and tell the people to do it over again. So for any little thing, you had to make sure that you were all right.
And what were the barracks like? Was it single beds, double?
It was a World War II. It was a World War II barrack. Upstairs, downstairs. They had a furnace that was fed by coal. You had people who were assigned to be. They called them firemen, but they didn't put out the fire. They started the fire.
Okay.
It was August when we were there at Fort Knox. It was hot and two-story. The sergeant had a talk with everybody, told us that, you know, everyone is to take a shower every day. He said, now, if you men will take care of it, if no one took a shower, I expect you people to take care of that person. Here's a scrub brush. Here's a bar of brown soap. Take them in there and scrub them. And I don't care, basically, get down the bone. Right? So everybody knew if they didn't take a shower, if they didn't keep clean,
they were going to be taken care of.
They were going to be taken care of. Said also, take care of any thieves, a barrack thief.
Okay. Were there any?
And there were. And people were thrown out of the second story window. All right.
What did people take?
People steal money. People leave out their wallet.
Okay.
People do things. People would steal a bar of soap.
Okay.
You know? So if people were thieves, you guys take care of them. They just left it up to us to take care of them.
And we did. How many men were in your group?
50 people in a bay.
Okay.
All right. And 50 upstairs, 50 downstairs.
Were they bunk beds?
They were bunk beds. And, you know, everything had to be clean.
Mm-hmm.
You had called butt cans, which were old coffee cans turned into a butt can.
Right, cigarettes.
But you weren't allowed to put any cigarettes in there. If you wanted to smoke, you had to go outside.
Okay.
This was just one more thing to keep everybody online, and everything had to be lined up.
Right.
And then you're allowed to smoke, you know, outside.
Okay.
And then you had to field strip your cigarette, open it up, strip it down, blow all the tobacco away, and then take the little thing, roll it up, and put it in your pocket. You weren't allowed to throw it away. Unless you took it and put it in the garbage.
Okay.
Now, for those, there were people that broke the rules, of course, and then we'd have to police up the area, which means we'd have to get on our hands and knees and go through the grass and clean up any butts or anything on the ground, any cigarette, anything that's on there, chewing gum wrapper, whatever it may be. And we'd have to clean up the whole company area outside, in the anywhere around. Any of us down there doing that. If the sergeant came in, found something, and it was 12 o'clock at night, he'd call out the whole barracks, and we'd be down there cleaning up.
So everybody paid the price.
Everybody paid the price. But that brought everybody together as a unit.
Right.
And so that's basically how basic training was going. It was changing us from a civilian point of view to a military point of view.
Tell me what a typical day was like. What time did you get up? How were you awakened?
Usually a sergeant would come in, throw a garbage can down the middle of the room, beat on things, tip over bunks. That's how he woke us up. And jumped out of bed, usually around 4 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they take us out for a run.
How much time did you have from the time he came barreling in to the time you had to be dressed in?
Within minutes. You had to be, you know, going, everybody outside and ready for your run. Your pants, your boots, a t-shirt, and your baseball cap.
Mm-hmm.
And then he take us for the run. And we go through the run, you know, running. I remember myself throwing up, you know, from the runs.
How long was the run?
Huh?
How long would the run be?
At least a mile.
Okay.
It was around the company area.
Okay.
Right? And the training area. All right. And then, okay, of course, there was other companies doing the same thing.
Right.
And so they'd get us up there, get us into shape, you know, and every drop us down doing push-ups, sit-ups, uh-huh, doing all that kind of stuff.
So a lot of physical, heavy physical stuff right at, yeah, the beginning.
Right.
Well, to break you so they could remold you.
Right.
And then also to get you in physical shape.
Right.
So how long did you do the running, calisthenics, whatever? That was before breakfast?
Yeah, we did that for at least 45 minutes to an hour in the morning, and then we went off to breakfast. Well, we went back inside, cleaned up the place.
Showered.
Then they would run us off to breakfast.
All together?
Yeah, everybody together. Everybody doing what they had to do, and you get your little tray, you go through the line.
Did everyone get the same thing, or did you choose?
Everybody got the same thing. You were so hungry anyway, you would eat anything.
So what did you give?
I remember pulling the trays off the shelves and the cockroaches running. There's cockroaches all over everything, okay? And shaking them off your tray.
So what kind of, beside cockroaches, what else did you have for breakfast?
You know, you'd have your, there was a lot of chicken, a lot of eggs, potatoes, fruit. They had your basic food, mm-hmm, all right? And they might take, everything was good if you put enough Tabasco sauce or ketchup on it. You
know? Okay.
You loaded it down and you're out there. Of course, you were so hungry you didn't think about that.
How much time did you have to eat?
You would have maybe 15 minutes to grab it, gobble it down, and out the door. And then you're back to the barracks again. Everybody would be outside. We'd start marching, and then he'd put us into a double time. We'd run back to the barracks, start cleaning, waxing the floors, doing whatever we had to do at that time, and then back outside for training. And then they would take and they'd march us over to the range. We had M14 assault rifles, as we say today.
Had you fired a gun before?
In the Boy Scouts.
Okay.
We had a .22 practice or whatever. And so we'd go to the range. We'd learn, you know, your weapon, M14s. Everybody was issued their weapon, their M14. You had your ID number on the weapon.
Your best friend, right?
Your best friend. And then, of course, then we had our own number, RA16837884, which was my service number.
Okay.
All right. And so then which is different nowadays, they go by your Social Security number.
Okay.
But now, back then, you had your Army military number.
Okay.
And so an RA meant regular Army. The other ones that were drafted, it would be U.S.
So were the draftees and the enlistees together?
Yeah.
Okay.
And mixed into that were also National Guard,
okay,
which were the no goods, NGs. All right, so if,
okay,
you're an NG, you're no good. Consider, you know, the real Army people.
Yeah.
They call them no goods because they're weekend warriors. They get in and get out, all right? They'd serve their 2 weeks or whatever and they're gone, you know. And so, of course, then a lot of National Guard guys did come on, mm-hmm, into regular Army, too.
Okay. So you learned practical skills like,
yeah,
how to use your rifle, how to take it apart, clean it, put it back together.
How to clean it. It was never clean enough. You'd take you could do it blindfolded. Matter of fact, you just about had to. You learned the spirit of the bayonet, which was kill.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You put the bayonet on the end of the rifle. You would do your lunges, your plunges, your parry left and hold,
mm-hmm,
you know, follow through, your stroke down. And that was drilled into your head over and over and over again.
So that would become automatic.
Yeah, right. And then you'd have to go through those courses and hand-to-hand combat fighting. And I remember the sergeant saying, you people will be in Vietnam in the next 6 months or less.
Mm-hmm.
So you better learn what you need to learn.
This could save your life.
Yeah, right. Save your life, save your buddies.
Right.
So we had first aid, we had map reading, we had all the essentials of basic training. But the big thing was to take and change you from a civilian into a serviceman.
Right, right.
That was the big transition.
So you
and then, of course, there were people that didn't want to, that went AWOL. And that.
And what happened with people who went AWOL?
One day do see them, next day you went. If they went AWOL, they might be put in the stockade, or they might have some other discipline or whatever it may be, depending upon what the company commander said.
Okay.
And so, but they can't have people, you know.
Right.
Running the army. The army ran them.
Did you have any contact with your family or friends back home while you were in basic?
We had a phone call we gave, it was once a week, and we'd stand outside the one phone booth. It was a line about a block long, and everybody was in there, and you had about a couple of minutes to talk on the phone, just say, hi, Mom, hi, Dad, everything's okay, or whatever it may be, and then you had to let go because you had your buddy behind you. He was looking too.
Could they send you things while you were in basic?
They could send you things, but it was kind of like frowned upon until you got off to your regular duty station.
Did anybody get things? Were there any repercussions?
There were people that did get stuff. Sometimes if the sergeant came by, things were confiscated, unless it was food. He said, you know, if you guys are going to get a little food or whatever, but basically you don't need anything. A lot of that stuff was basically kept from the guys because you never know what they would be supplying them.
Right.
And they didn't want that.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, so...
So how long was your basic?
Basic training was... How was it? 2 months. 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
And I remember getting sick in basic training and my buddies rallying around me and I had a high fever, then giving me water and doing what I had. And then, you know, they had a medic come in, gave me some pills when I got through it. But the nice thing to know is that your buddies are there taking care of you. Guys I'd never met before in my life are now my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all in it together, black, white, yellow, green.
Right.
We're all in it together. And don't give me this bullshit that I'm a white guy and I'm doing less than you are because, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're all doing it together. You know? And so it taught you how to work as a team. It broke down barriers. It was a big thing. I never lived with black people or yellow people or blue people before.
Mm-hmm.
And now we were all together as one. All right. And so it was something good, something. And the biggest and best thing is that they marched us off to chapel,
mm-hmm.
and the sergeant said, "See, this is part of our Army regulations. I will march you to chapel. If you find your way back to chapel next Sunday, that's you'll have to do it on your own. But under Army regulations, I will march you there once and once only. If you want to go back, it's up to you."
Okay.
I went off to chapel, slept through the whole service, as did everybody else, because we were so damn tired.
Right.
As I was leaving, I picked up a little pamphlet and said, you too can become the son of Christ. Put it in my pocket of my fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
Went back to, it was on a Sunday, of course. Went back, and we had like a half a day off. And I went back, went to sleep, woke up, and read that little pamphlet. And ever since then, changed my life.
The right time.
Right time. I went to church as a kid,
mm-hmm.
but I never had that connection before.
Okay.
And sometimes, just like they say, there's no atheist in a foxhole.
Right.
Well, I made the contact prior to the foxhole.
Right. So did you have any free time while you were in basic? Were you able to go into town or anything like that, or just sit,
no,
stay in your bunk?
No, it was not until after we were completed our,
okay.
we were just about done with all of our training and whatnot, and then we were allowed to go into Louisville.
Okay.
And, or go wherever we wanted. We had a pass for the weekend or something.
Like a 3-day pass or a 2-day pass?
That big. No, we were allowed to go out. We left in the morning. We had to be back that night by midnight.
Okay.
It was just a 1-day pass.
Okay.
And so, you know, we went out, came back, nothing big. You had your little free time. You went down to the Piazza and drank beer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And But basically, it was a time of one person helping another person, going out for your runs and encouraging other people to do it. Mm-hmm. So I looked at it as everything as being positive, even though it was terrible. I mean, you're crawling, you're doing this, you're under, there's shooting live ammunition over you with machine gun on the obstacle courses. It was ball busting, mm-hmm. but it was good at the same time. I could now look back and said, wow, I did all that shit.
Mm-hmm. So your 2 months are over. Yeah. Did they have any sort of ceremony? Or
they had a ceremony. They allowed your parents or whatever to come down. Mine didn't. My buddy's parents did come down, as did other parents. They had a parade ceremony. We marched off. And then we got our orders to where we were going after that.
And where were you going?
And I was going to Fort Jackson, South Carolina for advanced infantry training.
Okay. Train then, again? Did you get on the train again?
So we got on the train again and went to, from Louisville, we went down to capital of South Carolina. It's out of the name of, yeah. Top of my head. I can't think of it right now. But anyway, went there, got on some buses for Fort Jackson.
Okay.
Went to Fort Jackson. It was basically infantry or basic training advanced.
Okay, more of the same.
more of the same. You got into, you know, heavier weapons and things like that. And you hone your skills as being an infantryman.
Okay.
Right? And it was more of that.
Was it additional skills? Was it just more intense?
No, it was additional skills and not so much harassment. Now you're actually, you were a soldier.
You were a soldier, so now we'll teach you what you really need.
Now you're building your skills as infantry.
Okay.
And so there was less harassment, you know, less being, you know, I remember a sergeant, you know, they'd get in your face and scream and yell, they'd knock you down. I remember a sergeant grabbing one of the helmet liners that we wore, uh-huh. and was webbing in it, and punching a recruit in the head and driving him to his knees. And back then, the Army was ball busting.
Right.
Now, they give you a timeout and you have to go to your room like you treat a 5-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, that's what they do. They have timeouts.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. But that's where our little left society is taking us. They want to completely dismantle our military so we won't be able to fight anything. All right? That's my opinion. But anyway, so I do not believe in brutality, but I believe that war is brutal. And one of the ways of toughening people up is to toughen them up. And,
so you saw this as necessary. If you're going into war, you better be able to deal with this.
Yeah, you better pull your head out of your ass, because not only is your life on the line, but everybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And if you're going to be a jerk-off, which that guy was that got smacked by the sergeant, well, then he was a jerk-off. And he got humiliated all the way down to his knees. All right? And I don't know whatever happened to him, but hopefully he cleaned up his act.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it was most of the biggest thing I remember about, two biggest things I remember about advanced infantry training was we had a captain that came out to the field. It was November, December, something like that. It was raining and snowing at the same time. I said, hey, where's the sunny south, you know? And we're out there covered with mud, cold, wet, and the captain came out to the field. And he said, the sergeant yelled, make way, you know. And so we were all in line for lunch, right, at chow line. We're all standing here. And the captain said, no. He said, all you soldiers, go get back in line. He said, all you sergeants, get back to the end of the line. He said, I will be the last one fed. He said to the mess sergeant, call him Cookie. He said, Cookie, I'm going to be the last guy in line. He said, it better be hot, it better be good, and it better be a lot of it. And he was a new captain taking over.
Mm-hmm.
And he was called a Mustang. And a Mustang was an officer that came up through the ranks.
Uh-huh.
And he was World War II.
Okay.
All right.
So
greatest thing about being a leader is that he said, look it, you take care of them. And so you knew that he was going to take care of you.
Right.
He told the mess sergeant, there better be enough for mm-hmm. everybody. You sergeants get to the end of the line. You're not in the front. You take care of your men. Your men eat first. Your men, that's the most important thing, your men. That's a true leader.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Because he knew that some of those people would never come back again.
Right.
He knew he had to put those people in places where they're going to be killed or maimed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But while he had the opportunity, he took care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a mark of a great leader. Not the individual we have in power today as the commander-in-chief.
So,
that guy is not a leader of the military. He left one of our Marines to rot in a Mexican jail without intervening for 214 days, just got out. And people pleaded with the President of the United States, our Commander-in-Chief, to get him out. He did not. And he had PS, post-traumatic stress disorder. He did two tours in Afghanistan. And there was some congressmen and some senators that tried to help to get him out, but no one from the administration tried to get that man out. And he was finally released because he went over the border illegally. And he had weapons in his car, which you can carry in America, but he ventured over the long line and was busted. Anyway,
so,
off to politics.
You're in Fort Jackson. Was your day pretty much spent the same way it had been in Kentucky?
Pretty much so. You were given a little bit more free time. They eased up on you. There wasn't so much harassment. It was more about, this is the way, you have to start honing your skills. They mm-hmm. got you to a point of looking, acting and talking like a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Army time, the right way, the wrong way, the Army way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got you honed in on that. Into basic training. Now they took and developed your map reading, how to throw a hand grenade, how to use a bazooka, how to use a log or machine gun or whatever you might be using. So that was AIT. The second thing I learned besides all that military skill was my birthday December 9th. All right, we just got off out of the field, covered with mud. My platoon sergeant knew it was my birthday. We're back cleaning our weapons, and we're just all prepped up. And he said, hey, I understand today's your birthday. Everybody's talking about it. I said, yes, Sergeant. And he said, okay. He said, what do you want for your birthday? I said, I'd like to get a bottle of booze if I could. He said,
you're 21, right?
Yeah. He says, do you have money to buy it? I said, yeah. He said, okay, you and you, your buddy, go over by the front gate. And there's a liquor store across the street. Now, they're probably not going to let you go across the street, but you might be able to find someone to get liquor for you. All right? Another soldier to get liquor.
Uh-huh.
I said, okay. Somewhere's added. Anyway, we didn't see anybody that would do that for us, all right? A cab driver gets out of his cab, comes over. Do you guys want a ride, he says? And it's on the other side. Of the
yeah.
I said, no, but there's the liquor store across the street from the main gate.
Yeah.
I said, it's my birthday. I'll be 21. He said, oh, that's great, kid. I said, I have a $20 bill here. I said, I want to buy some booze with it. Get some whiskey, cheap whiskey,
yeah.
whatever you can buy and whatnot. And then you can keep, $5 for yourself. Back then, you could buy a bottle for a buck and a half or something like that. But I was going to buy it for me and my guys back, all right? So I said, okay, fine. He took the 20. He said, I'll be right back. He got in his car, and I said, I'm driving down the street. And we're both, me and my friends, kind of go like, the son of a bitch took our money. Anyway, never to be seen of again. So that's what I remember. That was my birthday present.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Anyway, got done with basic training or advanced infantry training, and then off to jump school.
Okay, how long was this advanced infantry?
Another 2 months.
So, okay.
Yeah, 2 or 3 months, whatever it was, 2 months. And
where was jump school?
Jump school was at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay.
We went there by bus.
So you were getting a good tour of the South.
Of the South, yeah, right. Anyway, went to Benning. It was 3 weeks for jump school. And then after jump school, then you would go off to wherever they were going to send you. I signed up to go to Southeast Asia. There was a wish list. You could go to Europe, you could go to Korea, you could go here, you could go there. And I signed up for Southeast Asia each time, all right? At the same time, I was telling them that I wanted to be a paratrooper and that I wanted to go special forces if that was open too. Anyway, going through jump school was great. They trained you, got you thinking about jumping out of airplanes. They went through a lot of jumps. You jump out of a second story window, learn how to roll and fall and things like that. Took you up in a 35-foot tower. You'd jump out the tower and a guide line would hold you from hitting the ground, but it'd give you the same feeling as jumping out of a plane.
Parachute, yeah.
And so you'd go through all that training. Then they got us into the planes. And so I remember we're all saddled up and going out to these, and they're old World War II airplanes, right? Flying boxcars. And they came from the Alabama National Guard. And these things are out there, and they're sputtering, they're spitting, and we're loading up, and I'm like, can this thing even get off the ground? Anyway, off we go. We get up. We had a drill in our mind, stand up, hook up, shuffle to the door, jump out, count to four. Okay.
What was that first jump? What did it feel like?
It was like everybody was so hyped up, but you couldn't stop yourself because you were programmed. Even if you didn't want to stop, out the door you're going, all right? Mm-hmm. Well, there's one little kid in front of us, about three or four up. He wouldn't go. And everybody was begging, oh, come on, to encourage him. Finally, just unhooked him, set him at the back of the... And everybody else, out the door. Poof, poof. Out the door, that prop blast hit us, blew us up, from the engine being right there, and the door's right there, and you're thrown away like that. He said, now, and we knew, too, if we got hooked on the bat tail, it would decapitate us.
Right.
We don't push off far enough. Or our chute could get caught up in there, and then you go to land the plane, and we're going to be dragged behind the plane.
You'd
be
right.
Dead. Either way, you're dead, okay? And so push out, whatever. And so, if you get hooked up with someone else, because all these guys are going out the plane, and sometimes you get caught up together, taught us how to get away from each other. First jump, yeah, everything went good. You hit the ground like a ton of crap. The wind takes your chute, it's dragging you across the field and everything. You learn how to release yourself. Fantastic. Four more jumps. Go off. We do another. Next day, go off and do another one. Next day, go off and do another one. I do three jumps. I come down hard on my third jump. I go out the door land on top of another guy's chute. My chute starts to deflate. And we hit the ground like a ton of shit. I don't break my leg, but I pull all the ligaments in my leg. I stop. I'm taken out of training. I'm on crutches. My class goes on without me.
Okay.
So I catch the next class coming in. I finish off my next jumps that I have to make. And now I could go to Special Forces. I had a Ranger course going, and they had Vietnam going. And I'm kind of like caught. If I go Special Forces, there'll be another year of training.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, shit, the war's going to be over. So anyway, so I said, hey, Vietnam, I want to go to Vietnam. And so they said, well, they had a slot with 101st Airborne paratroopers. So let's go.
Yes, see you.
Boom, boom. Out the door we go. Go up to California to place in there.
Did you have time when you finished jump school before you left to go back home?
I went home for a week or something like that. Saw everybody, said goodbye. And then off to California.
How long did you have at home?
About a week.
Okay. That must have been hard when you were leaving for California. It must have been hard for your family.
Probably so.
Because if they're seeing all the stuff on the news.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah, they knew that it was bad.
Right.
But the great adventure waited.
But you were still interested in the adventure.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
So did you fly to California? Did you take a train?
So tell you the truth, I cannot remember how I got to California.
Okay, where in California?
But, up by San Francisco.
Okay.
And there's a big terminal there. And from there, I was there just a couple of days, got equipped, and then we flew out of California, went to Alaska.
Alaska?
Landed in Alaska. And I remember the ice and snow and everything. It was dark, nasty. We were there for a couple hours. Then we flew from there to Japan.
Okay.
And then we stopped there for refueling in Japan. And then I remember flying into Vietnam. And it was, I remember the country and, you know, just flying. And I was in short sleeve shirts and everything. Got off the plane, and that heat just knocked me over. Like 110 degrees.
Yeah.
Knocked over.
How many guys flew with you on that plane?
The plane was loaded with guys.
Like 500?
100.
100?
Yeah.
Okay.
100, 150, whatever the plane would hold. It was a four-engine prop. And it wasn't a military plane.
Okay.
It was a chartered plane.
Okay.
Civilian charter plane.
So this is 1965?
This would be 1966.
66, okay. Yeah. And that's a long trip that you took.
Yeah.
What was the mood like on the plane?
Quiet.
Reality was starting to hit.
Yeah.
That's what
was like a 24-hour flight.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So what did you do on the flight to pass the time?
Sleep.
Okay. Were there guys that you had trained with on the plane? Did you recognize anyone?
No. Everybody was a stranger because I separated from my class
right.
And moved on.
Okay.
And so I went over as a replacement guy.
Okay.
And the so I moved on. And let me make a phone call here.
All right, hang on.
Excuse me.
Okay, so you landed in Vietnam and you said the heat knocked you.
The heat knocked me out. It was like 110 degrees. Humidity was 90 something. And then the smell
And what was the smell?
The smell was like just rotting, just like a rotten smell.
Okay.
That was at Tan Sanut.
And where?
Tan Sanut Air Base.
Okay.
Right outside Saigon. We went to a repo center there where all the new guys were coming in and other people were leaving. And we were there. And I was trying to get used to the heat, and you just didn't get used to it, you know. And they got us in there. They checked our paperwork to make sure we had all of our shots mm-hmm. and everything that we had to go, which we did back in the States. And I said, okay, fine, you guys just stay here until we call for you. The next day, which was in a tent, basically, and it was just unbearable heat.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, me and a couple other guys were assigned to ride shotgun on a garbage truck.
Okay.
We were issued shotguns, and a couple of guys had M16s.
Mm-hmm.
And we got on a garbage truck, and we went to this huge garbage dump. And I remember looking down into it, and it was like ants all over it, and they were people combing through the garbage. And it was our job was to move everybody away from the back of the truck when they dumped their load so no one would get buried.
Okay.
All right. And rats and people and flies and just, it was terrible. And the smell. And I got everybody back and the garbage came out. And I see these little kids and old people and whatnot lifting the cans that were thrown away from the base. What a terrible thing. Anyway, a couple of days later, they fly me up the Phan Rang, and I go through a quickie course in Vietnam for just to get my skill level up. I trained with the M14 rifle, but it was issued M16.
Okay.
So it was totally different than what I had. Did the a little bit of training, 4 days of training, that acclimated into the country and what we have to do. After that, I was assigned to, went to Tuiwa. and flew up there on a helicopter, me and four or five other guys. Got off, was assigned to 1st 327 ABU Company. Got off the truck, had my orders with me, went in and saw the first sergeant. It was rainy and nasty, and still hot as hell. And he said, okay, he said, Trout, he said, you're in 1st platoon. He said, get somebody here for the 1st. Guy came over, grabbed me, said, get your weapon out of that pile of junk weapons. So I had to take and get broken weapons, weapons that were through a battle, and we put together an M16.
You had to build your own M16.
Build my own M16, right. And I was told that I'd be going to 1st platoon, and here I'm at. I sent me over there, and there were like a couple of people there, and they had all these hooches, and which were basically just like little tents.
Mm-hmm.
And but not too many people around. And then people started to show up later on that day evening. And they're just coming off the field, out of the field, where they just had a terrific battle. No one talked, no one did too much. I was the new guy, the FNG. F,
mm-hmm.
New guy.
Mm-hmm.
F-E, new
guy. Yeah.
And so they took me out. I fired my M16. They introduced me around a little bit, which when you're a new guy, you're a piece of shit.
Right.
No one can trust you. No one wants you to even know who you are. All right. And they put me with a platoon medic, who was a good guy. Good guy. And he was relatively friendly to me. Next morning, I woke up, and a guy was walking toward our hooch, and the platoon medic said, oh, here comes Phillips. I looked down, the inside of his pants were all wet. I said, what's wrong with him? He said, just shut up. I shut up. Phillips dropped his pants, medic said, drop your pants, and his testicles and everything were all black and oozing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Nasty. He said, okay, he said, go to company sick call. He said, did you take the penicillin? Did you take everything I gave you? He said, yeah, Doc. Nothing's working. He said, okay, go to company sick call. He walked away. Doc looked at me. I looked at him. I said, what's that? He says, we don't know. He said, but nothing kills it. He said, so Trout, learn something. Don't have any sex here in Vietnam. You know? And I said, you don't have to worry about that.
That was enough of a message.
That was enough for me, you know. And I said, what's going to happen? He said, you won't see Phillips again. He'll get back as far as the Philippines, maybe Korea or Japan, but he won't go back to the States. Not until they clear it up, and usually they don't clear it up. So he'll die there in the hospital.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay. Just confirmed it.
Yeah. Right?
So anyway, a few hours later, well, we're told that we're going to be a reactionary force in case anything happened. I said, what's that? He said, well, if anything happens within this area,
mm-hmm.
we have our platoon will go out and take care of it. Okay, a couple hours later, two choppers are shot down.
Haven't you gone?
Run to the choppers. I'm with my sergeant. I said, what am I doing? He said, just follow me. We're going to go out there, we're going to secure the choppers, we're going to rescue the crews, we're going to put a perimeter around the choppers, and then until they get them out of there. Okay, fine. Go out there, follow my sergeant. They dropped us in a rice paddy, made our way to the choppers, secured everything, got the crews out of there, put them on their choppers. We started getting gunfire. Boy, oh boy. I'm in company less than 24 hours, and I'm already under fire.
Right.
Anyway, learned how to control fear.
Mm-hmm.
They started shooting at us through an open rice paddy. I jumped into the water. I realized I was a trout, but I couldn't stay in the water all the time. And came back up out of the water, got by a dike. Sergeant said, you know, fight, start shooting back.
Yeah.
You know? And so then we did that during the day. We had the, and he said, it's not going to get bad until tomorrow. When they get the, when they come in to get the choppers out, then we'll get really attacked. I said, okay. Next day coming.
So you spent the whole night in the panty?
Spent the whole night alongside these two choppers that were down. And there was about 20 of us.
Mm-hmm.
Platoon size around 50 guys. We're down to 27 guys.
So half then, your platoon is now gone.
Yeah, right. But because they've been shot up through the other battles.
Right.
And never replaced. I was a replacement.
Mm-hmm.
So we're already under strength and everything. And so next day, they attacked again. It was neat, because they called in air support, and they were shooting down at us from these embankments. And the jets would come in, and these Corsair World War II planes would come in and drop the napalm and whatnot. And that was pretty cool. None of my immediate guys, and no one was hit with anything, so we're all right. Sad thing is that after we did all this and we were shooting at people that were in a rice paddy, and I said, I don't know what I'm shooting at. He said, just shoot at that house out there. So I was shooting out there. Anyway, everything stopped, whatnot. Hour later. All of a sudden, we got these Vietnamese come walking down the road, and it was a little girl that was shot, about 10 years old. Anyway, she was shot. I remember the platoon medic patching her up, and then just sent her on her way.
Mm-hmm.
And she went down to a village or whatever. Went across the paddy, up over the railroad trestle, onto this high ground, maybe 150-foot high cliff that they had thing that came shooting up out of the paddies, you know, out of stone, like a little mountain all its own. Got to the top of it, stayed there that night. Remember being on the top of that mountain, and there, this is where I'm just getting to conquer my fears. And I remember the sergeant saying during training, when in doubt, whip it out. When in doubt, whip out your grenade, throw your grenade, blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. And I was on a listening post, and everybody else was sleeping. And it was my turn to watch and listen. And I heard this noise, and whatever. I tried to wake up somebody else, and no one would wake up. And I didn't know. So all I could think of, pull the grenade.
Right.
I threw the grenade, boom, you know, everybody starts shooting and whatnot. Pretty soon, anyway, calm down, you know, nothing. Right? Next morning, wake up, it was a water buffalo that wandered on this up the side of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Anyway, so after that, and being so humiliated, plus everything else, it was kind of like, screw it. And so we got done with that operation, went on some more operations. You know, place to place. Guys started to realize I wasn't chicken shit, or I was able to handle my fears relatively.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the nights were beautiful. The stars were as big as silver dollars. We're at a place called Fan Thiet. On the South China Sea,
okay.
And we were supposed to get attacked there, and we're up there, and the stars, and then they had the sampans down in the sea, little boats, mm-hmm. little lights on them. It was absolutely gorgeous, something right out of the movies. Right? And you wouldn't even believe a war was going on. And then you know, then you get a rocket attack or something. But that was kind of like how the war went for me. It went from things absolutely beautiful and things absolutely terrifying.
Right.
Things from terrible boredom. We went over to into Laos to, there was a, was about maybe 30 of us. Mm-hmm. We went through a special forces camp, and they wanted us to go into Laos to find, there was a flyer shot down, and there was some South Vietnamese troops that were taken prisoner. So we're looking for this prisoner of war camp, and they had it. So we're going in with people to get them out.
So you knew, you found the camp.
So we found the camp, and we had to march through this, or I should say, home through this jungle with ground leeches and mm-hmm. everything. And they were just covering our bodies and sucking the blood. And we finally did to the camp. We surrounded it and go in. They took the guys and they had tunnels going down to a river. And they took the prisoners and they got them out through the tunnels. But we were able to catch some guards and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And but we weren't able to get any prisoners out. Which was very, after doing, we were in the jungles for 3 weeks.
Right.
And so that was a disappointment and whatnot. But we'd go on operations. My last operation was when in Da To. And went there, they shot down a jet, I guess, or they had some heavy artillery up there. They sent our company in, and then our battalion, and we were all under strength. Fought our way up a mountain, and what we did was we ran into like a regiment. But this is how Vietnam was fought. They'd send in little groups to draw out the enemy.
Right.
And so that turned into, we fought all that night all the way up to the hill. And by that time, I was an RTO, radio telephone guy. I carried the radio for the platoon.
Okay.
Crawled in airstrides, crawled in, you gave everything to your, ran around with your company or your platoon leader, who was a lieutenant. We had a brand new lieutenant who was a jerk. He was a know-it-all West Point graduate. He was a first lieutenant, airborne ranger from Germany. And he just got in company maybe 3 weeks. And he didn't know what he was doing. He could do it in a book.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't know how to deal with people underground, or he didn't understand it.
Book right? Learning, not practical.
Right, right. And so, and I had to stay with him, and he wanted to play charge. All right. Mm-hmm. You want to take the job of the point man. Well, I already walked point. You know, now I'm an RTO guy. The people they want to kill, they want to kill the machine gunner.
Right.
They want to kill the leader. All right. They want to kill
the radio guy.
Radio guy. Maybe not me personally, but my radio that I carried.
Right.
All right. Anyway, we get attacked. We're chasing these groups down a mountain, and they're down a trail, and they're dropping their packs, and we're following them. Now I'm a PFC. We get to a Y in a row, and they dropped their pants from down here. And I look up, and I can see it looks like dug-in positions. And I told the lieutenant, I said, going into an ambush. I'll do it. No. I said, no. So I stopped everybody. He was ready to shoot me. I mean, really shoot me. I got to Sergeant Bell, called him up from the rear. I told him what was going on. He said, couldn't talk to the lieutenant. He had his mind made up. He said, this is what we have to do. We're on that trail less than 5 minutes when we walked right into the ambush. And a couple of guys that were walking point, a fox, forgot the other guy, and they were crawling back, and their intestines were all, their stomachs were opening up, and intestines were coming out, and they're holding them, trying to crawl one-handedly. And they go by us, and we're going in. And the platoon leader, lieutenant, got up to run. And I said, stay down, you know. He got up, and he gets shot. I dragged him back into me. He gets it in the shoulder and arm, and I called Sergeant Bell. Sergeant Bell came up. He was picking up the lieutenant, carrying him back. And I was calling the company commander, telling him the ship we're in, what's happening. And then a few minutes later, I'm shot. I get two in my radio and one in my head. And I, you know, it's like, oh, shit.
Where in the head did you get hit?
Along here.
On the right side?
Right side.
Okay.
Down like this, and it came and it blew. I got a plate that size. Side of my head.
About 2x2 or maybe 3x3? Yeah. Anywhere your skull is?
Huh?
To replace that part of your skull?
Yeah. And so, anyway, down I went.
Did you feel it? Did you hear
it?
It
was like getting hit with a baseball bat between the eyes.
Okay.
I'm laying there, and I reached up, and shit, you know. And then I'm like, okay, I'm by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm getting out of there.
Yeah.
Now I'm crawling ass backwards down this hill. And machine guns are opening up. People are throwing grenades. Or it's a firefight going on, big time. And I remember a guy yelling out, a machine gun on my left. And, what's the matter, Trout? What are you doing? You know. And I said, I'm hit. What? And they're yelling. I said, head. H-E-A-D. H-E-A-D. This guy that I never liked, could never get along with. He was an ammo bearer. Dumb as a box of rocks, all right? He comes running out, drags me out of the line of fire, down into an embankment where their medic was at. He was patching up everybody. Then they patch me up, and somebody said, what about morphine? They said, no, Trout got a head wound. Just leave him there. I'd patch him up the best we can. I find out 10 years ago, I get a letter in the mail from a guy. He says, I'm so-and-so. He said, I remember a guy by the name of Trout in Vietnam. So, okay. I call him up. I said, I'm Frank Trout. He says, I'm so-and-so. I said, I don't know you. He said, well, we found you laying in a creek bed. He said, no one was around. You were left for dead. I said, you gotta be shitting me. I said, I remember him dragging me, and I remember an MP, and I can never understand why an MP. He said, oh, we had all the guy from the rear came up, all the truck drivers and cooks and mm-hmm. MPs and clerks and things like that, because you guys are getting your ass kicked up there. We came up there, and apparently your company had moved on, and they left the dead because it was all under fire, and you were left.
So they didn't think you were going to make it.
They thought I died there.
Yeah.
If I was still alive, they'd die.
Right.
So anyway, they came up there, and they found me, and they, I said, I remember seeing some guys, and I remember being put on a guy's back, but he had an MP thing. I could never understand where the MPs came from. MPs were always in the rear.
Right.
Whatever. I said, no, he was one of the guys. We put you on his back. I said, I remember there, you know, was still fighting going on and everything. And yeah, he said, we had to crawl with you out of there and keep low. And I said, I remember being on this guy back, and I'm going, giddy up, you son of a bitch.
So you must have been going in and out of consciousness.
Yeah, I was in and out of consciousness.
Okay.
And so then they said, we dragged you up, and we put you, we got you to your platoon after, you know, they went up to this point where they found my platoon, found me with my guys. I remember that. My guys picked me up, and they stood me up. You know how you have a deer,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to take a picture of all the guys hunting with their weapons?
Yeah.
And they had strung me up. They had this turban on my head, all right? And they wanted a picture of it, all right? I wish the hell I could have had that picture. That would have been funny. Anyway.
So what do you remember from that?
I remember being dragged. I remember being finally reunited with my platoon. I remember them, everybody being pinned down. They couldn't land choppers because it was thick, heavy jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember they were loading the wounded into this big Chinook helicopter, right? Then they threw a line down, and they up we'd go, you know. Anyway, I got to the top. I remember them dragging me through the door and then placing me over by this on the thing, and then mm-hmm. off to the medic. This last, a year and a half ago, I was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and I went into a reunion. I haven't gone to any reunions in years. I walked into this room. Here's all these old men sitting around. This one guy says, holy shit. He said, the living dead or the walking dead. And I said, hi, guys. I said, I'm Frank Trout. The guy says, I know who you are. You're Trout. I said, yeah, Frank Trout. He said, I thought you were dead. And I said, I don't know you. So my name is Gary Stackhouse. He said, I'm in 3rd Platoon. I said, well, I was in 1st. He said, I know that, you asshole. He said, I was shot. They brought me into the helicopter, and they're loading the helicopter. It's hovering about 50 feet in the air. Yellow. So the, anyway, so I said, he said, I remember I was in the helicopter. They loaded me up, and they're loading all these guys. I remember they swung you through the door, and they dragged you over. He said, I was sitting on the side of the, inside the chopper on a bench. He said, they put you down alongside of me. You fell over to my lap. And I held you. He said, when you fell over, your bandage came off.
Oh,
he said, I looked down, and all I could see was your brains and your blood and everything. And then you stopped breathing. He said, we flew back to the MASH unit or whatever, and they unloaded everybody, and that was the last I saw you. They were loading you into a body bag.
They were loading you into a body bag?
Yeah. He said, I thought you died in my arms. Apparently, I had conked out again.
Yeah.
They did this and that. I remember awakening,
uh-huh.
In this, getting into this, putting the guy putting me into the body bag, and I was partially paralyzed. That was another thing. This side of me was not working.
The side that was shot was, the other side.
The other side. Yeah. The side of the head, that's this side of
right,
the body.
Right, the right side of the head is where you got shot, and your left side was paralyzed.
And so I remember mumbling something or whatever, and they took me out of the body bag and into the whatever. But Stackhouse thought
that you
had died in his arms. That was quite a reunion.
I imagine.
Quite a reunion.
So you went, they thought you died. You're in the chopper?
Yeah.
And where did they take you?
They came to, I don't know, where it was at, some medical, just a tent, all right?
Right.
And they unloaded us.
So like a MASH unit?
Like a MASH unit. They unloaded us there. They evaluated us. They, blood and everything else. And then they reloaded me into a helicopter. And they choppered me out of there back to a nice, warm, sandy place on the South China Sea. And there, they unloaded all the wounded. And the people that could be taken care of there, which mm-hmm. were superficial wounds or something, they'd probably be taken care of there. The serious stuff went on, all right? So that was like a triage area.
And where did they take you?
Anyway, back to, and I don't know which hospital I went to. But all I remember was warm.
It was still Vietnam?
It was still Vietnam. It was on the South China Sea. And I remember them unloading me, bringing me in to this Quonset hut,
mm-hmm.
and they're cleaning me up. I was in and out of consciousness, and then I remember this medic giving me a whole bunch of shots, one mm-hmm. after another in the leg, boom, 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 and I'm in and out of consciousness. They're talking to me. I remember looking at things and whatnot. They're cleaning me up. And next day I woke up. I'm in the Quonset hut, and along with everybody else, all these other wounded guys. And I remember one eye looking around, the other eyes being stand still, because I was still partially paralyzed.
Right.
I cried, And I was there 4 or 5 days until I got strong enough to fly back to the States. So then they medevaced me out of Vietnam, me and a bunch of other guys. Into the Air Force has these fantastic flying hospitals.
Right.
With all the stats of guys. And I remember guys dying above me and below me and around side me, and then people hauling people in and out and whatnot. And anyway, flew me back to California.
Okay.
Did a stay overnight there. Then they flew me on to Walter Reed in Washington.
In Washington. That was a long trip.
Yeah. And then at Walter Reed, I was there, and they just cleaned me up. And all the surgical work was done in that.
Okay.
And then they just cleaned me up and got me, I weighed 130-some-odd pounds. They got my strength back and whatnot. 5 days later, one of my hooch buddies. I'm laying there in a hospital in the neurology section, and all of a sudden they wheel a guy in, and they wheel him alongside of me. I looked over. It was my hooch big. He looks at me. I look at him. He said, "I thought you were dead." And I said, "What the hell are you?" He said, "What do you think? I just shot in the head too." And anyway,
So how long had you been in Vietnam before this?
I think February to June 7th.
So maybe five months?
Yeah, maybe 5 months. And from the time I stepped in country to the time I left, it was one operation after another. Just one thing after another. So from everything from going out to the jungle and being on a listening post, where you go out there with two other guys and you just listen, watch a trail.
Mm-hmm.
And radio back. Well, that's when I was a radio guy. Radio back anything you see.
Right.
And to coming in on hot LZs. I remember we were coming on Sidus Mountain, and there was a village there, and we fought up the side of the village. And matter of fact, a guy writes a book, and he mentions this operation that we were on because we were together. And he got shot there. I remember the helicopter pilot, as we were coming in, the first chopper went down, and they were shooting up through the through the boards and the floor, and it was hitting the propeller, you know, mm-hmm. the prop. And then we just all just jumped out. We were about 15, 20 feet off the ground, but we went it out of there.
Yeah. You know? So how old were you when this happened? 22?
21. 21. I was 20 when I joined. I was 21.
You turned 21 in
December 9th.
Right.
And then right off to Vietnam. So, and I was the third oldest guy in the platoon. The platoon sergeant, Sergeant Bell, was in his early 30s.
Mm-hmm. He was the old guy.
Korean War veteran. Great guy. Then we had Lieutenant Lee, who was a young guy, and then we had this last guy, and I can't even remember his name, nor do I even want to. The idiot from West Point.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So you had a short time.
Short time there.
There.
But every day we were out. We never were bad. Once I went to the base camp mm-hmm. where we were at, I never went back. We were always in the field.
Right.
Every day.
Right.
And that was one thing about the 101st. We were all over I Corps area, or 2 Corps area, Central Highlands,
mm-hmm.
from the South China Sea into the mountains and jungles.
So it was a little different than you thought it was going to be.
Yeah,
no partying at night.
Where's the party? What are we going to Saigon? You know?
Did you have any downtime while you were there?
Just the 1 or 2 days when we do search and destroy missions,
mm-hmm.
and then when we were completed with that, we stopped for a day or two, got resupplied, and then we'd be choppered out somewhere else, take on another operation.
What were your, where did you sleep? I mean, was it sleeping, did you have any sleeping bags or just on the ground?
Just on the ground.
Okay.
You had your poncho liner. And that was there was no bunks, no bed. That was all back at base camp, but no.
But you never made it back.
No, no one did. We never went back. Once we left there, we were always out on operations.
What did you eat?
Sea rations. And when we were up with the Mountain Yard Indians, we would get a hold of rice, and we might be able to get some chickens or ducks, stuff like that.
How did you prepare them?
I wasn't a cook, but there were other guys that were. And all I know is that you did a lot of rice, and then you take your sea rations and kind of mix it into someone's pot.
Uh-huh.
And I believe one of the guys either bought or stole one of the Mountain Yard Indians' pots. He had a cooking pot.
Okay.
And then we would empty everybody's stuff into it, throw rice into it, and whatever else we could find it, and load it up with Tabasco sauce.
So you couldn't taste it.
And made it into like a stew.
Right.
All right? And that's what we'd eat.
Okay.
But everybody lost weight. I had dysentery real bad. I remember crapping my brains out. And but I'll tell you what, you hate it when you're going through it, but once you're on this side of the mountain, it was quite an experience.
So you got back to Washington, and they treated you a couple days at Walter Reed.
Well, I was there
How long were you? A month?
A month.
Now, were your parents notified that you were there?
Yeah, I remember the Red Cross notified my mom and dad. They wrote a note. I remember the worker wrote a note, and I tried to explain what had happened. And then off that went to him. And then I was able to, when I got to Walter Reed, I wrote another one. But this was extremely rough on my mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
Especially to know that I've been shot in the head.
Right, right.
And so it was very rough on them and the family and all everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I was able to, thank you, God, recoup myself pretty well, and I was, you know, drooling, and I was partially paralyzed, but I was able to make it home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after not too much downtime and therapy. And then I went back to Walter Reed for another 3 or 4 months for therapy, and I was there at Walter Reed Hospital after going home on medical leave, and then back there again. And then they said, you can get out of the military. And I said, no, I said, I got this hole in the side of my head. They said, well, we're not going to do anything with that for about a year. And I said, well, I said, you know, I got 3 years to serve.
Mm-hmm.
I want to serve. They said, okay, you go back to the 101st. I said, that's where I want to go, because not all 101st were in Vietnam. Only one brigade was in Nam. The rest of the division was back in Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
And what were you doing there then?
So anyway, I went back to Fort Campbell, was reassigned back into a paratroop infantry outfit. All right. Walked into the first sergeant's office. He was already screaming at two other sergeants. I remember looking around the corner. I remember these sergeants. These guys were E-7s, which was a big deal, platoon sergeant. And this first sergeant, who was World War II guy of Korea, little sergeant, about like that high, that's a good guy. Screaming and yelling at him. I'm going like, holy shit. Anyway, I knock on the door, and he yells at me, get in there. And I come in. He gets the other sergeants out of there, of course. Asked me, what did I want? You know, reporting.
Yeah.
And he looks at it, and I had a medical profile.
Right.
An arm long, no prolonged standing, walking, talking. I couldn't wear a helmet if I did. You know, I couldn't wear a helmet. I couldn't do this. Couldn't do that.
So your head had dented.
No, it was still.
It was still concave.
It was a hole, and you'd see my pulse beat through the side of my head.
Oh gee. Okay.
And it was all. Plus, it was all red.
Right.
It was. It came back after a while, but it was all like that. He said, "Well, what in the hell am I going to do with you?" And I said, "You know." You know, as soon as they fix me up, I'm raring to go, you know. Anyway, they assigned me to the hospital, or to the artillery chapel.
Okay.
There I ran into Chaplain Curtis Bowers, who was our chaplain in Vietnam, who won the Silver Star. Great guy. And he said, oh, you know, Trout, he said, I was supposed to baptize you, because I remember I met him on the South China Sea. And he was running around, a bunch of other guys were playing ball. And he said, comes up to me, he stunts on his hand, he said, I'm Curtis Bowers, Chaplain Curtis Bowers. He said, boy, are you saved? I said, saved, sir? He said, saved, are you saved? Or have you been baptized? I said, I don't know, I don't think so. He said, I'm going to baptize you in that river over there. Anyway, we never were able to do that.
Uh-huh.
My first week back at Fort Campbell, Curtis Bowers grabbed me, baptized me there at Fort Campbell.
Okay.
And I became his driver and assistant during that time. I was hooked up with the infantry company, but I was assigned as a chaplain's assistant. And became a sergeant, was in charge of, I made Spec 4 as soon as I came back.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I came back to PFC, and I was in the washroom in my company. And next door to me was the company commander, the captain, I forgot his name. And he had already met me after I talked to the first sergeant.
Right.
And he looked at the first sergeant with me and was like, what are we going to do with this guy? You know, I mean, they were good. I mean,
right.
They're good guys. But they, you got to be willing to jump out of a plane or can. But
yeah.
I couldn't do anything like that. So until they fixed me up. So they took care of me because they knew I still had the airborne spirit. You know, I'm still a warrior.
Right.
You know. And so anyway, so you're PFC. So you should be, you're an RTO. You should have been in Spec 4. I said, well, that's what I thought I was going to make it now. And he said, okay, I'll get it for you. Anyway, so I'm sitting alongside of him going to the washroom.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, a soldier. And it was next door. They had a little partition. And I said, yes, sir. So this is Captain So-and-so. He says, you have any toilet paper over there? I said, yes, sir. I said, hey, pass some under it. I said, this is PFC Trout. He said, yeah, Trout. He said, pass it over. I said, remember, you were supposed to make me Spec 4. He said, Trout, don't give me your shit. I said, well, I got a whole roll here, sir. He said, okay. So anyway, passed it over. Got you Spec 4. And anyway, then I, a few months later, as I got better and whatnot, I became a sergeant.
Okay.
And
so at like 22, you were a sergeant.
Yeah, 22.
Okay.
And I was, when they fixed me up, when they ever fixed me up, I was preparing to go back over with the 2nd Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they were sending the whole rest of the division over there, and I was supposed to go. And I was preparing to get my plate in and then go over. Well, there was a delay on some things, and I went off to Walter Reed Hospital for my plate, and the rest of the division was activated. They went to Nam. By the time I got back and the plate in my head and everything, I missed the deployment.
So this is like 67?
67, yeah.
Okay.
And anyway, so then I was back at Fort Campbell. And they, everybody left.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reassigned at the hospital chapel, because I was part of the
right.
There. And I started working with the chaplains, because they knew me through Chaplain Bowers. And served the rest of my time there at Fort Campbell at the chapel.
Okay.
And. I remember the chaplains were complaining that not enough guys were showing up for the services. And so they asked me, since I was the nice thing about it is I used my position as being infantry. I was an infantry sergeant.
Right.
Right. And chaplain's assistants were basically clerk typists,
mm-hmm.
which I couldn't do either. I mean,
yeah.
So anyway, I went up, it was a Sunday. I knew that the chaplains were upset because not enough guys were coming to the chapel. So I went up there. I got a hold of some Angelica wine, put it on a cart, took a case upstairs on a Sunday evening, no one around, and I was having communion. I told the guys, look, I want you all to show up for, I don't care if you're Catholic, Protestant, whatever.
Okay.
So anyway, I was able to get the guys to come on down, and I would go up, take care of the troops, and then they'd show up
mm-hmm.
for mass or for the. I had a Baptist, I had a Methodist, I had a Lutheran, and I had a Jewish guy, a Jewish chaplain, and I had a Catholic priest.
Okay.
And I said, I don't care, you know, what your faith is. Start showing up. You know? And so we worked out an agreement. A few months later, they did an IG inspection, and they wanted to know why we were going through so much wine. At the hospital chapel. And I was kind of like thinking, remember there used to be a series on TV called Sergeant Bilko.
Right.
You're probably too young to remember.
No, I remember it.
But anyway, Sergeant Bilko was always wheeling and dealing. I kind of considered myself like a Sergeant Bilko, you know? Something that Bilko would do, you know. But it was all in the best interest of the troops and the soldiers and the chaplains and everything like that. Anyway, I got out of the Army.
Wait, where were you discharged?
I was discharged out of Fort Campbell.
Okay.
And it was September of 1968. Went back home.
Did your family know you were being discharged?
Yeah. By then, my father had passed away.
Okay.
He died at age 42, heart problems. The military got me through that rough part of my life. And I was thinking about staying in the military and going
back
to Vietnam, you know, and as infantry, because then I had my plate and everything. I still had seizures and different. No, I didn't have any seizures then. I still had speech problems and drooling and whatnot, but relatively okay. So I get released from the military and went back, worked in construction. They were rioting and doing all sorts of crap at the time. Well, just like at Fort Campbell after Dr. Martin Luther King was murdered.
1968, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember there were bands of roving soldiers, black guys, at Fort Campbell with baseball bats beating up white guys. I think they might have even killed somebody during that terrible time. All right. Now, I can understand them being upset, but I can't understand their actions. All right. Dr. Martin Luther King was a man of peace.
Right.
And that was totally a messed up situation. But anyway, got on the military, wanted to make a difference. Applied for the police departments. I remember I went to Chicago after getting out, and I walked into this policing in Chicago at the Austin station. We lived in the Austin area when I was a little kid, and so I thought I'd go back there. And I asked the sergeant on duty, I said, hey, I want to get a job. Where do I go? He said, who sent you, kid? And I said, no one sent me. He said, well, come here. He said, he looked around, he said, got $500? And I said, no. I said, I don't have $500. He said, well, get the hell out of here then. So anyway, I took I took the police test, and I got hired in Westmont. And I was a cop there for 22 years, a youth officer, and a patrol sergeant, detective sergeant. And I would work part-time for the Westmont Fire Department. There was an opportunity. The fire chief was retiring. I took the interview for the fire chief's job and won the interview. Became retired from the police after 22 years, started with the fire, and became fire chief, and that's 22 years. And, old World War II guys, American Legion, VFW guys,
right,
said, hey, Frank, are you getting anything for getting shot in the head? I said, no. I said, I didn't want to screw up anything for the police department or anything like that.
Right.
They said, well, look, go over to VA. You're not getting anything? I said, no. I said, I've got a clean bill of health. I'm fine. They said, well, go over to VA because later on down the road, you might need you might need help with this. I said, okay, fine. So I go over to VA, bring in my DD-214 and do the whole bit. A few months later, I start getting a disability check. Now, this is after 2 years of being a cop, right?
Mm-hmm.
2 years after that, I start going blind every now and then in my right eye or my left eye.
Okay.
All right? And it would lose whatever. And I went over to Hines. They said, well, you're probably having seizures or whatever. Here's some phenobarbital and Dilan. I said, you know, that wasn't really working anyway. Blah, blah. It just made me feel bad, worse, really. So
made you tired, probably.
Yeah, and so I just dealt with the situation over all these years. And then finally, it was about 10 years ago, I got cancer. And I went over to Hines, or I took care of it myself through my own insurance. I was asked to become the commander of the disabled vets for Chapter 5 in DuPage County. I did that, and I said, well, look, I'm going to go over to Hines and see how it is, because the last time I was there, this place was a garbage pit. Went over to Hines. Hines has cleaned up its act, VA, wonderful, and doing the right stuff. And so they put me through a program at Hines. They said, you know, your cancer comes from Agent Orange. And I said, oh, really? Well, plus you have post-traumatic stress, PTSD. I said, really? I said, that was 40 years ago. I said, I didn't know that. I said, yeah, because of all the stuff and everything, and they did a screening. They did the whole thing.
Right.
And so, anyway, here I am now. That's a number of years later. Still trying to be a good soldier. still trying to do the right stuff and be a good American. And no regrets from Nam. It was a difficult war. We had incompetent political hacks. The President of the United States and McNamara, LBJ and McNamara, were trying to run a war that a general should have won. We could have been and should have been out of there within probably 2 years if they would have done the right stuff and fought it as a war rather than nickel and diming it. And whenever you allow political hacks, such as the President and his advisors, to get involved with things like that, that's what you get. What really upsets me about it is that so many Americans turned their backs on the soldiers after mm-hmm. we did everything we could do. And I understand maybe some of their frustrations, but they have to understand this too. Communists came into Korea, took over Korea, and then we kicked them back to the 38th parallel.
Mm-hmm.
The communists took over Vietnam with the support of the American people, not all of them,
mm-hmm.
but that's what an incompetent leadership from the top down, that's what helped lose the war. Well, we didn't lose any of the battles. We lost the war through incompetence, through the liberal left, through phonies that they had in there, and but not through the actions of the guys on the ground. They did their job. They did it well. And there was sure it was screw-ups. There was
My lie.
And that guy should have been put up to a wall and shot. And anybody right. else that kills babies.
Right.
Now, we had little, you know, 12, 13-year-old kids throwing hand grenades at us. And they were combatants. You shoot them. But you can't shoot babies and unarmed women.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Anyway, that's my basic take on it. Right.
So you are still active with veterans organizations.
Yeah, I'm the American Legion Commander, Post 338 for Westmont, and I'm the Disabled American Vets Commander for all DuPage and Kane County.
Do you have any close friendships that lasted beyond your time in Vietnam?
No, I don't. I think there's a closeness from what we remember. I remember at our reunion, Jeff, I won't name his last name, or Gary, who I met at the reunion, who held me in his arms on
right.
the helicopter, and Jeff, who he and I met at the reunion after all these years, and he was my hooch mate, and we met at the reunion, or right prior to the reunion, he saw my name somewhere and gave me a call. And we hooked up. I've been down to visit him and things like that. But once 40 years have gone by, you have your relationship during war, during whatever.
Right.
You know? And you could do that, but life, you still, at least with me, you move on.
Mm-hmm.
And so while they were good memories and everything, and while they're brothers in battle, all right, we weren't able to keep a relationship going all those years. So you do move on with your lives.
Okay.
And also my own personality of, we used to move around all over the place when I was a kid. I was in eight different grammar schools before the seventh grade. So I was always making and breaking relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably has developed my personality to, I'll be your friend, and I'm here for you, and then goodbye.
Right.
But if we hook up again, terrific too.
How did your military experience affect the way you think about war, like when you look out in the world today? You know, all the events happening around the world.
All the events happening. What was great to see was like in 1990 when they did the 100-hour war. The first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
They went in, they completed their objective, they did it, the president said hands off, let the generals run it, here's your parameters, go to it. And they let the generals run the war. And the generals were Colin Powell,
mm-hmm.
all right?
Right.
And he, along with the other generals from the Vietnam era, said, hey, wait, we're never going to do this again.
Right.
You're going to have an objective and do it and complete it, And I always respect them for doing that. Now, it isn't so.
So,
matter of fact, I think President Obama has made it more, he politicalized everything, where all the really quality generals are leaving the service, and admirals are leaving the service in groves. And who's staying behind? You know? There's been the politics and the social engineering that they're trying to do in our military. The military, leave it alone. Just don't, you know, the last place you should have stopped with was don't ask, don't tell. There's been gays in the military forever, all right? But, don't, you know, it was basically a don't ask, don't tell kind of a deal, all right? Unless they're going to be going out and doing something ridiculous, mm-hmm. all right? Leave it alone. And but they don't. They try to social engineer, and the military is no place to social engineer. Women have a place in the military for everything that they can do competently. All right, I don't care about the danger. Mm-hmm. They want to sign on the line. They're just as patriot as I am. They got outstanding Duckworths.
Tammy Duckworth.
Yeah. She was a helicopter pilot.
Right.
She did an outstanding job, and look at her.
Yeah.
All right, quality person doing a quality job. They can do those things, but they can't be paratroopers. They can't be SEALs. They can't be Rangers. They can't be your basic infantry force because 99.9% of them can't do it because they don't meet the physical endurance. All right, just like a lot of weak men can't do it. So you don't bend the rules because of the sex. If a man can't do 100 sit-ups in such and such minutes, and a woman can't, her should not be reduced down to 80 or 50 mm-hmm. just because she's a woman. Do not move the standard. If 100 men have to, and don't reduce the standard, just to accommodate weaker sex,
right.
whether it be male or female. If they're competent enough and physical enough to do the job, let them do the job. But there's too much social engineering with the military now.
Okay.
Right. And I do have to leave now.
Okay. Anything we haven't talked about that you want to mention before we finish?
No, I got in everything that I wanted to.
All right. In that case, thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for your service, and we're going off record.